Lines. Iran says intra-Afghan talks with the active participation of all groups are the only means to bring peace and stability to Afghanistan. A survey shows Americans increasingly say the events of September 11, 2001 have changed the United States for the worse than better. Also ahead, thousands of Syrian civilians are returning home in the southwestern city of Daraa after the exit of foreign-backed militants under a settlement agreement. Welcome to World News from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Starting this bulletin in with news regarding Afghanistan, Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations calls for the formation of a truly inclusive government in the country that it's emerged from a free and fair election.
Indeed, the path to a stability, durable peace and sustainable development in Afghanistan passes through intra-Afghan talks, with the active and equal participation of the true representatives of all ethnic, linguistic, and religious groups aimed at finding a just, peaceful, and durable solution to the crisis, achieving national reconciliation, and establishing a truly inclusive, broad-based, and fully representative government that is emerged from a free and fair elections, including with the full participation of women both as voters and candidates.
Addressing a Security Council meeting, Majid Takht Ravanchi expressed concerns over the presence of terrorist groups in Afghanistan. He said terrorists like Daesh must not be allowed to operate in the country. The Iranian diplomat also condemned a recent attack by the Taliban on Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley, where there was a resistance against the group. Takht Ravanchi described the attack as unjustifiable. He stressed that Afghanistan's dire situation, where millions need humanitarian assistance to live by, is the direct result of the 20-year U.S. war in the country. He noted that war crimes by foreign forces in Afghanistan must not go unpunished. The United Nations Special Envoy for Afghanistan, meanwhile, urges the world to keep money flowing into the country, despite concerns over a Taliban government.
Billions of assets and dollar and donor funds have been frozen by members of the international community. The understandable purpose is to deny these funds to the de facto Taliban administration. The inevitable effect, however, will be a severe economic downturn that could throw many more millions into poverty and hunger, may generate a massive wave of refugees from Afghanistan, and indeed set Afghanistan back for generations.
Deborah Leon said safeguards must be created to ensure that the transferred money would be spent where it is needed and not misused by the de facto authorities. The UN envoy added that there were, quote, credible allegations that the Taliban carried out reprisal killings despite their promises of a general amnesty. She said the premises of the United Nations in Afghanistan have been respected for the most part. She, however, stressed that the world body is increasingly worried by a growing number of harassments and intimidations against national staff of the United Nations. Political commentator Jason Onure says Western powers can't punish the Afghan people just because they don't like the Taliban.
You know, just because the Western powers don't actually like the Taliban or the way the Taliban does business or the fact that they lost the war to the Taliban, this is absolutely no reason to punish the people of Afghanistan. In fact, it would be a very heartless measure to simply cut off aid to the poor simply because you don't like who the government is. I mean, this is what we're supposed to believe, that the whole point of going to war in Afghanistan was to, you know, fight terrorism and liberate the Afghani people. Well, there's nothing very liberating about going hungry or not having any medical treatment available for anyone who needs it. In fact, withholding these would definitely show the true intention of the United States, and that it was only intended to control the country, and many of the other Western powers as well, such as the UK, that their only real intention was to gain control of the country.
The foreign minister of Qatar has held talks with senior authorities in Pakistan to discuss the current Afghan situation. Qatar hosts the political office of the Taliban in Doha and has played a key role in the peace efforts. Kamran Yusuf has the details.
The visit of Qatar's foreign minister is the latest in a series of visits undertaken by foreign dignitaries to Pakistan in recent days. Following the visits of foreign ministers of Germany, Italy, UK and Netherlands, the visit of Qatar's top diplomat also focused on Afghanistan. His visit comes just days after the Afghan Taliban announced an interim government that drew criticism from certain Western countries for ignoring the demands of inclusive setup. Speaking at a joint news conference, Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi said the immediate priority must be the well-being of the people of Afghanistan.
And the most important thing that we both agree to is that we have to protect the interests of the people of Afghanistan. And for that, their safety, their security, stability, and to ensure that this Afghanistan, you know, does not become an arena for, you know, for proxy wars.
Since the Taliban took over, there have been fears of economic meltdown as the international financial institutions and Western countries suspended the assistance.
Humanitarian situation and the humanitarian assistance should be independent from any political progress, because we believe that the Afghan people deserve to be helped, deserve to be supported, despite what's happening in the political landscape.
The Qatari foreign minister said the inclusive government is important for the unity of Afghanistan. The interim government announced by the Taliban was contrary to the commitment they made earlier that the political dispensation would be inclusive and broad-based. The interim government is set to take oath on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 attacks in the United States. Many countries are closely watching the Taliban whether they live up to the promises. But Pakistan and Qatar maintain that the world community should not take any steps that may aggravate the problems for the people of Afghanistan. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Also, a U.S. media report, or poll rather, says many Americans believe that events after September 11th, 2001 had a more negative than a positive impact on the country. According to the survey conducted by The Washington Post and ABC News, 46% of the people say the events of 9/11 changed the country for the worse, while 33% believe they changed the country for the better. That represents a large swing from the first anniversary of the attacks in 2002. Back then, 55% said the country had changed for the better. Nearly 3,000 people were killed on 9/11 when hijacked airplanes smashed into the World Trade Centers in New York. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens. Residents of Dar al-Balad in southwestern Syria have returned to their homes after a deal which led to the Syrian armies taking control of the town from armed groups. Our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, has visited the area and filed this report.
For the first time in 10 years, the Syrian army has entered Dar al-Balad in Dar'a city. This is an implementation of a long negotiated deal with armed men that collapsed many times because of their violations. 9 checkpoints for the Syrian army have been established to ensure security after 900 armed men reconciled and surrendered their arms. Russian military police is also there, patrolling and supervising the deal's implementation. The Syrian flag was also raised on Al-Manshiya police department inside, signaling the return of law and order to the area.
فاليوم احنا نعود.
Today, Daro al-Balad returns to Syria with efforts of people and security forces. Reconciliation talks have been successful. The armed forces and police have entered the town and 9 security checkpoints have been established.
The government's control over Dar'a al-Balad will lead to the reopening of public institutions and providing basic services to the residents, as well as reconstruction.
As you can see, security and stability have been restored. The town has a strategic location along Syria's border with Jordan. The restoration of public services is highly important for the residents of Dar'a al-Balad.
Meanwhile, Al-Mukhayyam Quarter remains under the control of armed groups who refuse any peaceful deal with the government, similar to some villages west of Dar'a. Thousands of people who left the town before a peaceful deal were allowed to return to their homes, marking the end of yet another chapter of an armed conflict in Syria. The military regaining control of Dar'a al-Balad is a testament to what Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said time and again, that the army is determined to retake every inch of Syrian territory. After 10 years of war, the government continues to prioritize peaceful solutions to end any conflict like the one here in Dar'a al-Balad. Hamad Ali, Dar'a al-Balad, southern Syria.
Palestinian groups and factions have declared Friday a day of rage to protest against Israel's decision to relocate inmates following a jailbreak this week. In a statement, the resistance movement Hamas called on the Palestinian people to voice their anger at the Israeli occupation and its aggression against prisoners. In the meantime, a Palestinian Authority official warned that Israel's, quote, repressive practices could spark a new uprising. On Monday, 6 Palestinian inmates broke out of a heavily guarded Israeli prison. The regime has launched a manhunt for the inmates. Palestinians have warned Israel of major unrest if any of the 6 prisoners are killed. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held several rallies to condemn Israel's new violent measures against Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails following the escape of 6 Palestinian inmates from Gilboa prison. Ruba Shabit reports from the besieged Gaza Strip.
Palestinians organized several rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, where tensions mounted as Israeli regime began to practice a brutal crackdown on Palestinian prisoners and transfer them to new facilities. Palestinian inmates set fire to cells protesting the Israeli violent measures against them that have doubled after 6 Palestinian inmates escaped Jalbu prison early this week.
Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails have been facing a war crime, especially after the heroic escape by 6 Palestinian inmates from Jilba prison. Israel has adopted violent measures against Palestinian detainees, including solitary confinement.
Palestinian resistance factions called prisoners to resist these attempts to transfer them to various facilities, describing the condition in Israeli jails as war crime that requires urgent move to protect the Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Prisoners Club warned that tension would escalate between Palestinian detainees and the Israeli regime over the relocating of some detainees from the Islamic Jihad movement, as most of the 6 inmates are affiliated with the group.
The Palestinian resistance has a clear message that any Israeli attack threatening the lives of the prisoners will lead to serious consequences, and the Israeli regime will pay a heavy price for any violation. Our Palestinian resistance is ready to defend our detainees. Also, it's a national Palestinian duty to provide safety for the 6 heroes who have escaped the Israeli prison.
Palestinians called the international community and human rights groups to make serious actions in order to protect the Palestinian detainees from the Israeli violence.
We hope that all Palestinian detainees will be free soon. We are here to support our inmates. We won't remain silent amid the international community's apathy towards the issue. We will raise our voices against the international conventions that are only written on paper with no practical results.
6 Palestinian inmates escaped from the high-security Jilbu prison in northern parts of the occupied territories on Monday, prompting a massive manhunt by Israeli army.
Along with its manhunt for 6 Palestinian detainees, the Israeli army has practiced violent measures against detainees inside jails. Palestinians here say they can't remain silent as the prisoners' issue is among their top priorities. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The British government has come under fire during a heated debate on Islamophobia at Westminster Parliament after failing to adopt any definition of Islamophobia 2 years after promising to do so. Our correspondent in London has more in this report.
The British government has come under renewed condemnation after failing to honour their pledge to define Islamophobia 2 years after making the initial promise, with MPs and critics all condemning the lack of action amid rising Islamophobia across the UK. An all-party parliamentary group on British Muslims created their own definition of Islamophobia in 2018, describing it as a form of racism.
Islamophobia is rooted in racism and is a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness.
Regardless which political group makes the definition, grassroots British Muslim groups are concerned over what they see as an establishment-pushed definition.
The best case scenario for this definition of Islamophobia would be one that forces the government to critically self-reflect and critically analyse its policies and policies of previous governments that have led to Islamophobia. I do specifically mean the so-called counter-extremism policies, which have just been a thinly veiled excuse to surveil the Muslim community. And these policies have had such detrimental impacts on the mental and physical well-being of the Muslim community. It's so likely we're going to have a watered-down definition that is nothing more than empty words. Why? Because there's been no engagement with the grassroots of society. There's been no engagement with organisations like ours, like MPAC UK, or CAGE, or MEND, or, critically, active masajid like Lewisham Islamic Centre. There's been no engagement with organisations like these which have had to deal with the mess created by 20 years of suspicion and policies and institutionalized Islamophobia.
Some have already begun to adopt the definition, including the opposition Labour Party. However, accusations of Islamophobia within Labour remain, despite its implementation.
A lot of scepticism still surrounds this definition, with many fearing that it will ultimately fail to serve the community effectively, if at all. However, while MPs continue to procrastinate on the issue, Islamophobia remains a very real and persistent threat on both a street and systemic level. Robert Carter, London.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The
Taliban have announced an all-male caretaker government, including an interior minister wanted by the FBI, on a day when at least two people were killed by violent policing of street protests against the new authorities in Afghanistan. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Emma Graham Harrison and Akhtar Mohammad Makoui. The piece is titled, Taliban Name All-Male Afghan Cabinet, Including Minister Wanted by FBI. Stay with us for more. Taliban have announced an all-male caretaker government, including an interior minister wanted by the FBI, on a day when at least two people were killed by violent policing of street protests against the new authorities in Afghanistan. The leadership, unveiled on Tuesday, 7th of September, is drawn entirely from Taliban ranks. Despite promises of an inclusive cabinet and many of its senior figures are on United Nations sanctions list, which is likely to complicate the group's search for international recognition. Late on Tuesday, 7th of September, a U.S. State Department spokesman said, "We note the announced list of names consists exclusively of individuals who are members of the Taliban or their close associates and no women. We also are concerned by the affiliations and track records of some of the individuals. We understand that the Taliban has presented this as a caretaker cabinet. However, we will judge the Taliban by its actions and not by its words." The U.S. State Department renewed its call on the Taliban to offer safe passage to U.S. citizens as well as to Afghan citizens looking to leave the country. Afghanistan will once more be officially known as an Islamic Emirate, as it was under Taliban rule in the 1990s. The Prime Minister will be Mullah Muhammad Hassan Akhund, one of the founding members of the group, who was close to its original leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar. He has had far less international exposure than other senior Taliban leaders, but as head of the group's powerful leadership council, he is one of its most influential members. Mullah Muhammad Omar's son, Mullah Yaqub, will be defense minister in the new caretaker government, and the acting interior minister is Sirajuddin Haqqani, who is on the FBI wanted list. In his first statement since the Taliban seized power last month, Mullah Muhammad Hassan Akhund said Afghanistan's new rulers were committed to all international laws, treaties and commitments not in conflict with Islamic law. In the future, all matters of governance and life in Afghanistan will be regulated by laws of Holy Sharia, he said. The Taliban face a major economic crisis, domestic pressure from political opponents, and an uprising in Panjshir Valley that has not been entirely stamped out despite their capture of the provincial capital in Panjshir. International pressures were highlighted by protests in Kabul that drew hundreds of people and which, although initially peaceful, ended in the Taliban firing guns into the air, beating protesters and journalists, seizing equipment, and detaining some people. A smaller protest in the western city of Herat ended with two dead and at least four injured, according to the Afghan newspaper Ittala-e Tehruz. The Guardian saw video of Taliban dispersing protesters with gunfire. With domestic reserves frozen and the country long dependent on international aid, there is also a desperate search for international legitimacy that may allow funds to keep flowing into Afghanistan. The government lineup is unlikely to offer progress on any of those fronts. Instead, it appears primarily designed to prevent internal fractures within the Taliban movement, after weeks of heated internal discussions about power sharing, said Harun Rahimi, a law professor at the American University of Afghanistan. It won't help with domestic legitimacy. It won't help with international recognition. It will not help ease the resistance, and it will not help government run more smoothly, he said, pointing out that few ministers had expertise in their portfolios. So I have to conclude that the only reason they chose this kind of makeup was to make sure there will be no internal fractures. The new cabinet is also heavily dominated by the Pashtun ethnic group that formed the Taliban's original power base, but which makes up only about 40% of Afghanistan's population. Just three appointees in the new caretaker government appear to be from other ethnic groups. It was unveiled by the government spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid. Asked about the lack of inclusivity, Mujahid could offer only vague promises that the minor portfolios outstanding may be awarded in a way that broadens the government. Some ministers and deputies and many top positions are remaining. We will try to include people from across the country into it. It's not a permanent cabinet, and we will try to make it more inclusive, Zabihullah Mujahid said. Another sign that Taliban promises of change, including respect for media freedom, were being tested by the reality of governing. Zabihullah Mujahid said people should not be protesting at this time because the country had recently emerged from a crisis. He also suggested that some protesters were incited from abroad, a possible reaction to the fact that many of those on the streets were attacking the Taliban as an instrument of the Pakistani government. For two decades, Pakistan provided the Taliban with safe haven, and the head of its influential Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, or ISI, spent 3 days in Kabul this week as negotiations about the new government were hammered out. But the Taliban and Islamabad deny any significant ties. There were no immediate response to the new government from the countries that have bankrolled Afghanistan's aid in the past, and now face the prospect of engaging with a leadership dominated by figures who are on United Nations sanctions lists. There is pressure for the international community to work with the Taliban to try to stave off disaster for the most vulnerable of the country's 38 million inhabitants. The United Nations has warned that access to food aid and other life-saving services is close to running out, as concerns mount that the country is facing a looming humanitarian catastrophe. The grim assessment from the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs came amid an appeal for an extra $200 million in emergency funding in Afghanistan after the Taliban's takeover sparked a host of new problems. The United Nations says 18 million Afghans are facing a humanitarian disaster, and a further 18 million people could quickly join them.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners. Today is the second of the month of Safar, a day after the survivors of the massacre of the Prophet's progeny at Karbala were dragged to the court of the tyrant Yazid in Damascus. we invite you to reflect on the words of the Holy Prophet's granddaughter, Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, when addressing the godless tyrant Yazid in his court. The end of all tyrants is terrible, and God knows the misguided and wrongdoers amongst you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Regarding the approach of Dr. Ayati in his book, he's trying to put some lines between the authentic stories in the history and the non-authentic or fake stories in the history. Also, he's giving some evidences regarding the time and the era of Muawiyah that why Islamic society is going to kill the grandson of His Holiness.
The work of Mr. Ayati will be fall in historical war. And specifically with respect to his work, investigation into the history of Ashura, we might say that the dominant context of his work is historical war.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two Islamic experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyainia. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Mahdavi. Welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Zainab, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So we are mainly concerned with the life and the works of one of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars and figures in the field of history, and especially the history of Islam and Shia history. He is no one but the late Dr. Muhammad Ibrahim Ayati. Although a cleric, a clergyman, he got his PhD in the field of Islamic philosophy from the University of Tehran, active in both Hauza and University. He was a man of Hauza and University. So, Sheikh Mahdavi, let's get to you, brother. One of his most outstanding works, I mean the late Muhammad Ibrahim Ayati's works, is dedicated to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the history regarding Karbala and the Day of Ashura. What is that book exactly?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Actually, we have to say late Dr. Ayati has authored three works with respect to the Ashura. One of the book is Investigation into the History of Ashura. Another book is The Discourse of Ashura. And the third book is actually the collection of his speeches, which is called the Sarmaye Sohan. We might say it Precious Lectures.
Okay.
And with respect to the first book, actually we have to say, which is Investigation into the History of Ashura. This is a compilation of his lectures being compiled by Mr. Ghaffari.
That's right.
And these are the lectures being delivered in the radio.
Oh, it was a radio show?
Yes,
first?
during 17 lectures being delivered in the radio.
Okay. Radio in Persian language on that time in Iran?
Yes, during 1 year.
Yes,
during 1 year.
Okay.
So this is generally speaking about the topic of the works that he has done. But in terms of his methodology with respect to writing the book, before we get into his methodology, we have to say that authors, with respect to the issue of Ashura, could be categorized into four categories. Some authors look at the history of Ashura from the viewpoint of history. It's a kind of mere history or analytical history.
That's right.
Another angle that authors have looked at the history of Ashura is a metaphysical angle that okay. from this aspect they're looking at the history of Ashura and this yes. uprising. And another category is the emotional
one, that's
category
right.
from this point of view. They
mostly
are
concerned with the rituals and sha'ayir or
definitely.
Something like that, okay?
And the fourth one is the mystical.
Or the Irfani one, that's
yes.
right.
So if okay. we wanted to say which one of these categories the work of Mr. Ayati will be fall in is the historical one.
That's right.
And specifically with respect to his work, Investigation into the History of Ashura, we might say that the dominant context of his work is historical.
Historical one, that's right. So he's considering all the events which took place about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam according to the historical fact and historical context. I mean, the first things that comes to the minds of the historians are the realities which took place on that time, is it?
Yes, and the okay. main thing that he's doing with respect to this very important issue is to take all reports and oh. historical reports from the first-hand resources.
Okay, the first authentic ones, that's right.
Yes, okay. this is very important thing. And when he tries to deal with this okay. aspect of Ashura, one of the challenging points he is facing at his time is the distortion being entered in the history of Ashura.
Ashura, that's
so
right.
through handling history of Ashura from this aspect, he's trying to say that we have a lot of exaggeration and superstition
yes.
things
yes.
being mixed
yes.
with the true story of the Ashura.
That's right.
So he has no way except resorting to first-hand resources
that's right.
in order to prove his idea
okay.
right.
That's
that
right.
there are a lot of distortions that we have to put it aside in order to get the pure
okay.
story of Ashura.
That's right. So this is the main research methodology of the late Ayati regarding the day of Ashura and the history of Karbala. But Sheikh Ziya, what is the place of now, I mean, for example, Ahadith or the Quranic verses in the historical look? I mean, are the historical look only concerned with the socio-political and cultural facts which took place on that time? Because most of the time, the historians, when they want to picture a context of an event, they get to these details. Where is the color of divinity in the historical method now?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Something that we must take into serious consideration here is that ahadith and ayat mainly are not the source of history.
Okay.
But sometimes they are giving us some hints. For example, the birth of Prophet Jesus.
Yes.
Some details about the event of Prophet Noah and his ark.
That's right.
Or some other issues that historians are looking for and they don't have some, you know, original resources.
That's right.
Here, Quran as a divine book is coming and giving some evidences to us,
that's right.
some hints to us. But Quran is not a history book. So it is not giving us the all details about the event. No, for example, about the birth of Prophet Jesus, it gives some part of the story and then we don't find the rest of the story
that's
in the
right.
book.
Okay.
So about riwayat, somehow the context is a bit different.
That's right.
We have more, you know, details in riwayat sometimes because riwayat are elaborating the verses of the Holy Quran sometimes, and this elaboration gives more details regarding the historical events. But again, riwayat also always are not the sources in history. It's maybe we can say that it's an evidence beside
oh,
other evidences.
That's right.
For example, sometimes we are looking for archaeological
yes.
evidences.
Yes.
Beside that,
mm-hmm.
we may go to also books
that's
of
right.
ahadith and also the Holy Book Quran.
Mm-hmm.
So, but these books are not history books.
Yes.
This is important point. But
okay.
Regarding the approach of Dr. Ayati in his book,
mm-hmm.
yes, he's trying to put some lines between the authentic stories in the history and the non-authentic or fake stories in the history.
Yes.
But also, he is giving some evidences
regarding the time and the era of Muawiyah, that right. why the Islamic society is going to the direction that after 50 years of the demise of the Holy Prophet, they are deciding to kill the grandson of His Holiness. I mean, Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
And do you believe that this method makes the story of Karbala more believable?
For sure.
For the rational people.
For sure. And Dr. Ayati is trying to highlight these distortions in the Islamic society. So, late Dr. Ayati, first of all, he is trying to differ between the truths and falses.
Yes.
And secondly, he is trying to give evidences that why this movement was necessary for the
Muslim Ummah that time.
Yes, Muslim Ummah.
And as Imam Hussein alayhi salam in his last will and testament to Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya wrote, that this is for the correction or reformation of the Ummah of my grandfather and my forefather, that is Rasulullah, and also forbidding the evil and enjoining the good. That's all right. And through this historical, or it's better to say, realistic lenses on the eyes of a historian like Ayati, we can understand the context in which the Muslim Ummah, or Islamic community, is better to say, was deviated from the right path. Right after the demise of Prophet Muhammad, just 50 years after that, they are ready to kill and slaughter Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, his faithful companions, the peoples whose fathers were working and practicing Islam and embracing Islam for Prophet Muhammad, and went here and there in order to fight for Prophet Muhammad. But now what happened, that in 50 years the true path of Islam is deviated.
This is the exact point that Mr. Ayati at the continuation of the book refers to.
Okay.
That okay, because the situation was too dark, just giving speeches, that just speaking with people or just giving some advices to them was not enough for the Islamic society to get back to the right direction of Islamic beliefs.
That's right.
So that's why Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam decides to go to the battlefield of Karbala.
Karbala, that's all right. That's all right. Sheikh Mahdavi, any point missed?
In terms of the realistic approach of Dr. Ayati, we might add this point that you might be rebuking people of Kufa. Why they didn't join Imam Hussein? He is saying that you have to go and read and see the history in the context they were living in. They said, okay, by the moment they were inviting Imam, reading the letters, the invitation letters for Imam, they felt that we have heard Imam Hussein is ready to go against Yazid, and he's the only son of Imam Ali who may handle this. Yes. So let's write invitation letter for him.
Yes.
But by the moment Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad entered Kufa and threatened them, terrified them, they said, okay, if we join Hussein, he's going to kill us.
Kill us.
So they were really like ordinary people. Okay. You just try to put their shoes and then judge yourself.
That's
Don't only blame them.
Okay.
This is with respect to the realistic approach that he had, and also from the history, the historical thing that are mentioned, like visiting the Karbala in the same year. For the actually the doing the Ziyarat al-Arba'in for the same for the same year, because he has a realistic approach. He's saying that this is impossible. It can't be true.
That's right.
Why? Because of the distance from Syria to Kufa and the time they were taken as a captives in the palace of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, and then from there to move to Syria. It is impossible to come back and give a visit to Imam Hussein's shrine in the same year.
Yes.
So he is that brave that he is going to go against all historians who mention this, no matter who is saying such a point.
Okay.
He's saying this is impossible. So we are not going to give any authentic look at such a point. So he was really kind of realistic historian, trying to investigate history based on the facts, not based on emotions and things like this. So this is concerning the realistic approach that he had.
But I think still this type of methodology regarding the history of Islam and the Shia Islam has influenced the late Shahid Mutahhari and the following generations. Still, we have so many scholars and the ulama today who are looking at the history in this way. And I think this type of look at the history of Islam and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam opens a kind of dialogue with the other denominations and other religious minorities too. Because when you now look at the religious scholars from the other religions like Christianity and Judaism, you can see that they look at Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is a very historical one. And in that historical context, they can find how Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was brave to do such an action against the notorious Yazid, and how his measurements were successful during the history. And this makes Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, I think, more believable for the people who are coming generation after generation, and is accepted by other religions, other denominations, rather than Islam and the Shia Islams too. May Allah bless the soul of Dr. Muhammad Ibrahim Ayati. His works are still recalled and remembered, and we can say still many scholars and students and the house students and university students benefit from the outstanding resources that he compiled during his life. May Allah bless his soul. Unfortunately, we missed him very soon. In a car accident, 1343, in the fall of 1343, so many years before the Islamic Revolution of Iran took place, but he's still remembered in the minds of the people and the scholars all across Iran and the world of Islam. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi.
You're almost welcome.
And Sheikh Ziainia, for your nice elaboration regarding the research methodology of the late Dr. Muhammad Ibrahim Ayati, regarding the history of Islam and the history of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and Karbala. And thank you very much, dear audience, for listening to us. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. You can download for free our previous episodes on this program. Also visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah.
I don't fear if from your cradle you depart.
The light. The German capital Berlin turns colorful as the annual mural festival has brought artists together to display their works around the city. Artists have instilled new life into neighborhoods with giant murals that attracted hundreds of visitors. This year's event was resumed under the motto Home Street Home after its 2020 edition was canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Organizers say the paintings invite people to discover the city as a gigantic open-air gallery.
The Italian city of Venice has held its annual historical regatta festival, attracting hundreds of spectators. People wearing costumes rowed their colorful boats and gondolas through the city's Grand Canal. The participants reenacted the city's history by carrying people dressed up as the King of Venice and his wife up the canal. Some of the riders also put their strength to the test by racing each other throughout the day. The regatta dates back to the 13th century and has been held every year in September.
An extraordinary concert has entertained hundreds of people in the German city of Dresden. Musicians performed underwater while five steamboats accompanied them with their whistles. The City Symphony Orchestra organized the event in an attempt to boost up people that is exhausted by the COVID-19 pandemic. Residents welcomed the program, describing it as a glimmer of hope. They believe that the unusual concert was good for heart and soul.
Young generations are becoming more concerned about our planet and seem determined to contribute to make it environmentally friendly. A great example is this Parisian boy who spends a lot of time fishing metals out of rivers and canals in the French capital. Good for him. 11-year-old Raphael uses magnets and grappling irons to fish metal objects out of the Seine River in Paris. Over the past 2 years, he has taken hundreds of bikes, scooters, and shopping trolleys out of the water. The boy says the practice was initially a hobby for him, but it eventually turned into a reasonability and a method to raise awareness about climate and environmental issues.
My goal is to raise awareness so that a maximum of people do something. They don't have to do what I do, but at least do something. Even if it's not necessarily cleaning up canals, it could just be picking up a cigarette butt.
Raphael has also fished some very rare items out of different canals, including handguns, pieces of jewelry, and an artillery shell. An exhibition is therefore being held in Paris where Raphael's findings are going to be put on display. The young environmentalist has also been awarded the Medal of Paris, a prize belonging to the residents who accomplish a deed concerning the city. Brazilian researchers have discovered a substance that could be used as a drug against COVID-19, and you may not like where they found it. A group of scientists have come across a potentially life-saving molecule in the venom of a kind of Brazilian pit viper. It is a peptide or a chain of amino acids that limited reproduction of the coronavirus in monkey cells by 75%. The peptide can be synthesized in the laboratory, so there is no need to capture more vipers. Now the researchers will evaluate whether the molecule can be used to create medicine for treating people with COVID-19. Thousands of cows have descended from their summer quarters in the Swiss Alps to enjoy the warm temperatures of lower heights. The cattle herds spent 7 weeks in the Alpine mountains, grazing at an altitude of nearly 2,000 meters. Their journey down started before sunrise and took almost 5 hours to complete. The cows, which couldn't make the trek due to injury, had already been carried down using trucks and helicopters. Farming has found an alternative look in the Netherlands, where cows produce milk on an eco-friendly floating farm. That may seem a surreal image of Rotterdam, the largest port in Europe. A herd of cows peacefully feed on board of what is known as the world's first floating farm. They live on the top floor of the three-story farm, while their milk is turned into dairy products on the other two floors. The floating farm opened in 2019. The owners say it aims to show the future of breeding and farming.
You must realize that the world is under pressure. Therefore, we have less and less land, agricultural land. Our idea is that in this way, we can actually create agricultural land close to the city and also adaptable to the climate.
The floating farm is seen as a good alternative for normal farming in the Netherlands. That's a country with scarce land while being threatened by climate change. The farm's owners have also applied eco-friendly methods to make it durable and self-sufficient as much as possible. The methods include using solar panels and feeding the cows with grass from sports fields.
Australian cyclist has become the first woman in history to pull off a front flip on a mountain bike. Caroline Buchanan landed the front flip at the OD9 cycling event in the German city of Birkenfeld. The maneuver won the former two-time Olympian the women's best trick title in the event. This was the first time the Nines featured a female category. The annual event gathers the world's best slopestyle and freeride mountain cyclists to Germany. A spectacular light show has mesmerized people in a Greek capital, Athens. 200 colorful drones performed a short harmonized display illuminating the night sky. Their colors and shapes were changing alongside music tracks. The show, organized by the Athens Cultural Center, took place 120 meters above the National Opera and Library. An Afghan woman has received the gift of life at a most unlikely time while flying. 26-year-old Saman Nouri was on a plane bound for Birmingham when she started having contractions. She gave birth to a little girl in an altitude of 10,000 meters with the help of the cabin crew. Born in Kuwaiti airspace, the baby is named Hawa, which means Eve or air in Dari. Both mother and daughter are completely healthy. The aircraft was carrying Afghan citizens evacuated from Kabul. The passengers left behind their old lives, but were gifted with a new one in the process. After all, life does find a way.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A French graffiti artist has created a monumental mountaintop project to encourage a more contemplative approach to life, aiming at lifting people's spirits. The giant 1,500 square meter painting is called A New Lease of Life. It was painted on the summit of Mollison Peak in the Western Swiss Alps. The 32-year-old artist says he was inspired by the likeness of childlike wonder. The mural depicts a little boy blowing bubbles in an area known for its clouds. The artist says he wanted to reflect the link between children and sky gazing.
I think we live in a world that includes anxiety, and we need a little lightness to balance it. So I believe that the clouds mean dreams and imagination. When we were kids, we liked to imagine shapes in the clouds and so on. And I believe that this is a moment where we have to breathe and also imagine the world of tomorrow with a certain lightness through daydreaming.
Saip also says he designs his creations to fit in with the environment using biodegradable paints made from natural pigments. The French artist is known for his massive graffiti works on grass that are best seen from the air. Some of his other works have adorned an impoverished shanty town in South Africa and the lawn in front of the UN headquarters in Geneva. One of Mexico's largest zoos has launched a one-of-a-kind exhibition, with the star of the show being a manatee couple. Visitors will be able to see the couple at the new exhibition, which is part of the largest aquarium in the country. The zoo received the manatee couple from the Caribbean with the intention of raising awareness for the protection of the species. Part of the ticket proceeds will go toward conservation efforts. Manatees are fully aquatic, mostly herbivorous marine mammals that are sometimes known as sea cows. These